This podcast is proud to be part of the TalkSport Fan Network. TalkSport. Powered by fans.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
The TalkSport Fan Network is proudly supported by McDelivery, bringing you the food you love. McDelivery brings a top-tier lineup of food right to your door. No matter the result, you'll always be winning with McDelivery. Order now on the McDonald's app and you'll get rewards points delivered too, so that ordering today means some tasty rewards for tomorrow. Only via app at participating restaurants. 18 plus rewards registration required. Points only on menu items, delivery fee and terms apply. See mcdonalds.com.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the Green and White podcast, brought to you by Argyle Life. Argyle's Easter weekend got off to the worst possible start, well, except maybe for being literally crucified, I guess. Morgan Whittaker scored with his head, much to the surprise of his girlfriend on Twitter, but that proved only to be a false dawn, as Sargent drilled home and Ashley Phillips unfortunately completed the Canary comeback for a 2-1 victory for the home side, their seventh win in a row at home. A major talking point after the game for Ian Foster was Alfie Devine gunned down by Norwich's goalkeeper. Well, he certainly did go down like he was shot. But in spite of the improved performance by Argyle, we are now without a win in our last five games. We're live on all the usual platforms, Twitter, Facebook, YouTube is probably best. Longer questions on YouTube really start grilling us, particularly the People's Champion, who is now with us, Sam Down. Unfortunately, Aaron's not here. He is too busy celebrating a victory for his beloved Norwich City. So joining myself, Stan George, on the pod today. Down by name, but his internet is no longer down. He's still standing up, though. It's Sam Down. Good evening, Sam.
Hello. Yeah, it's not a problem with my internet. It's a problem with my MacBook. I'm doing this on my phone, which means the camera angle is even more weird and wacky than the already weird camera angle you're normally used to. So I'm now having I suppose I could sit down in theory because I'm on my phone, but it's blimey, I don't know what happened with my Mac. It's very odd. I've never had that. It decided that Well, two things, really, without the viewers.
I'm going to cut you off because I'm not sure we necessarily need a full breakdown of your technical issues, but I will introduce the rest of the pod. Ringing my bell tonight, it's Joe Bell.
Good evening. Yeah. Off the producer's sub bench, I wasn't meant to be here, but one of our regular panellists decided he'd display a spell of his own incompetence with his social calendar. So I'm actually having to front my face on camera tonight. So yeah, no, really looking forward to trying to piece together what happened yesterday.
Yes, thank you, Joe. Thank you for stepping in at the last minute. And I don't have a pun for his name, but he's the stats guru. It's Ben. Good evening, Ben.
Evening, mate. It's great that we found the Argyle fan, the only one who's got worse puns than Aaron, to come and host this. That was quite an achievement. Nice to have you on. And in your first show, you managed to get Sam Down to do something he's not done for any other host, and he's sat down. It's quite impressive stuff. We're expecting great things.
Yeah, that is unusual. And maybe that will be why I might usurp Aaron and host the pod full time from now on. So, yesterday, 2-1 defeat, but according to a lot of the people who were there, certainly from what I've seen on social media, Pasotti, etc., an improved performance. Sam, you were there yesterday at Carrow Road. What were your thoughts?
I think it certainly was an improved performance, yeah. Not still not a brilliant performance, certainly better than the average. I think we started the game well, really went at them quite early doors, which we haven't seen too often in recent weeks. Lovely bit of play for the goal. It was a ball straight out wide by, I believe, Randall, and then out to Sorinola, who then whips in an inch-perfect cross for Whittaker. Normally with Whittaker in that position, you might maybe think, you know, it's a little bit far out for a header. Is he going to try and take it down? What's he going to do? But no, he gets his head in it and he directs it perfectly into the corner. I still think if you're a Norwich fan, you're going to be a little bit disappointed. Gunn's been beaten by a header from such distance, but Whittaker does get a bit of zip on it. Certainly gets good direction on it, right into the corner. As you alluded to in your intro there, Stan, very rare header for Whittaker, but it was a good one. After that point, we still did have chances. Hardy could have made it two, angled shot. Norwich had chances of their own, of course, quite a few of them. Were we a little bit riding our luck to go in at halftime 1-0 up? Possibly, but it was still a good half, for sure. Then second half comes out. I thought, you know, first 10, 15, I was thinking, well, it's only a matter of time till they score. And funny enough, at the point at which they did score, it was when we were pretty much on our most comfortable spell of the game up to then. They didn't really like getting close. Then they got a corner and they obviously scored from that corner. Quite sloppy marking. Sargent was just absolutely acres of room. The short corner routine was his undoing. I think it was Devine who was meant to be picking up Sargent, so it was quite poor from him. And then the winning goal just after, there was the incident with Gibson being off the pitch, which I'm sure we'll do to death later. But let's just say, you know, we were down to 10 men for now. And yeah, you know, obviously it's a bit bad fortune to be down to 10 men, but all we had to do was defend one set piece. Gibson was going to come back on about 10 seconds later. All we had to do was just get that set piece done, but we couldn't manage it. I think it's Houghton and I think Sousa. He sort of just goes between those two. You know, it's kind of a zonal setup we've got, but neither Houghton nor Sousa pick him up, and he then just gets it in for 2-1. And then there's the Devine incident, which, you know, we'll talk about again later. But all in all, a better performance than probably the average under Foster. If you've got to put Foster's batting average as a tepid, low-energy performance, yes, it was better than his average, but still a lot of holes to pick in the performance. I still think we were too deep first half at times. I still think that we didn't really throw enough at it towards the end. I think it was 7 minutes of stoppage time. We didn't even get the ball in there. Didn't even get the ball in their half, or certainly not in their penalty box in that stoppage time. That was very poor. And I just still think the use of subs were baffling. So was it a better performance? Yes. Is it enough for me to change my view on Ian Foster? No, absolutely not.
Fair enough. Joe, do you have anything to add to Sam's summary of the game or...?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, he mentions there that perhaps we were slightly fortunate to go in 1-0 up. And whilst I sort of understand that, I'd also argue that Ryan Hardy missed a brilliant opportunity in that first half to make it 2. I accept that there was obviously the moment where I can't remember which Norwich player it was, got free on the left or right, which they seemed to do quite a lot in that first half, cut it across and Josh Sargent just decided to be 3 yards ahead of play and missed what would have been a routine tap-in. So it had its bright sparks that first half, it really did. And I just think overall across the piece for 60, 65 minutes, I thought it was a pleasing performance. I certainly don't agree with the head coach's thoughts that it was an excellent performance, because I think actually there were still quite a few areas where we need to significantly improve on. Was it a step in the right direction from what we've had recently? Yeah, it probably was against a side that are competing in the playoffs, albeit were far from their best yesterday. But unfortunately, as I've said many times on this pod before, the old wounds were reopened. And unfortunately, our soft underbelly, which we do have because we are a bit of a soft touch, was on full show. And I don't know what others thought in the ground, certainly those that were watching at home like I was, when Norwich got one, unfortunately, I sort of believed they were always going to get a second. Did I then see us getting a second ourselves? Not really. I know Hardy has a one-on-one chance, doesn't he, that the keeper saves. Perhaps his touch was a little bit heavy when he got into the box. And there's obviously the penalty incident that we'll talk about a little bit later. But the overriding problem I've got is we gave away two really poor goals. No matter what you think about the referee's decision to force Gibson off after the physio comes on, they are dreadful goals to give away. And, you know, that's a real problem that we've had because, you know, I was quick to jump to Foster's defence in saying that the style of play had changed because he was going to make us more solid. We've had two clean sheets since he was appointed on the 5th of January or whenever it was. So that's a real issue. And one thing we are going to have to shake off in the remaining seven games is we're going to have to stop being a soft touch. We're going to have to, you know, a lot of people won't like it, and certainly those at the club won't like it. We're going to have to develop a nasty streak. We're going to want to become a team that no one is going to want to play over the next seven games. Is that going to happen overnight before Monday? Probably not. But somewhere, something has to change quickly, whether or not it's somebody just stands up in the dressing room and launches an almighty tirade at others, I don't know. But there needs to be a nasty streak come out on this side because everyone else seems to have it. And there's a, you know, you look at Sheffield Wednesday, QPR, they've got players in their side who would grab the game by the scruff of the neck, and it's sort of led to their upturn in form. The likes of us, Blackburn, Birmingham, perhaps we're struggling to find that character. So it wasn't for the lack of trying. It wasn't for the lack of endeavour, but it's a 9-10 minute period, unfortunately, like we've had in a lot of games in recent times that have just unravelled the afternoon for us.
Do you think some of that might be due to the inexperience in the side, maybe? So we all know that we've got a very young squad. Maybe there could be a use for some of the more experienced members of the squad, so players like Joe Edwards, Adam Forshaw, Jordan Houghton, over the next few games, just to sort of provide that leadership.
I don't think that the squad's that much younger than it was previously, was it? We had KKH in, we had a number of, you know,
sort of men. Over this season, I think compared to a lot of other teams, we've had quite a young squad.
Well, I think we showed a lot of mettle. How many, you know, think about Stoke, we think about, you know, Rotherham, games where the team was able to come back and score late on with young players taking the game by the scruff of the neck, Morgan Whittaker, Finn Azaz, etc. I think the difference might be here that there's more pressure on each and every, there's more jeopardy in every opportunity we create. You know, I made the point, we're averaging under Foster 3.5 shots on target a game. Now, that's enough by the league average of goals per shots on target to score one goal a game. So you're basically having to be ruthless if you want to, you know, unless you're going to win 1-0 every game, you're going to have to be really ruthless. That puts a pressure on you every time you get the ball. Like Ryan Hardy missing the open goal. I mean, it's open goal from an angle, but missing the open goal. Think about the pressure that put on him. He's thinking, I might not get, you know, we're going to get 3.5, we got 4 shots on target. That's what we're producing this year. The pressure that puts on you, even as an experienced striker, let alone the young players, whereas before, it didn't matter. You miss it. Like, how many games has Hardy had, like 6 or 7 shots, and then put 1 or 2 of them away? So I think it's not necessarily the immaturity or the youth that's a problem. I think there's a real pressure created by the limitations of the system. I think that's where the issue lies. And ultimately, the system did all right. Yesterday, there was movement, which there hasn't been, but it wasn't really any better than some of the performances we've seen using this system this season. Like Middlesbrough, obviously, the standout, but I even think the first half, Ipswich was at home, rather, not at Ipswich, against Ipswich, was pretty decent. There's been moments where the system has operated and worked well, but you only produce a limited number of chances. That puts a lot of jeopardy and pressure on those and means you have to hold out defensively. You know, the team did play really well. There was lots of things to like. We ultimately were playing a team that was better than us. And once they score, as Sam said, once they score one, you think, well, we're not really going to probably get the chance to get the second. And then they go and get the second. You think, well, we're probably not going to get the chance to. And that's not on the players. That's on the way the system's set up to play, because it's been consistently generating that for the past 13 games. That's the way the system's supposed to work. You control build up, and then you pounce when you get the opportunity. You create few but very high quality chances. We're just not, I mean, defensively, there's one point that I've been seeing going around that people are saying, oh, you can't blame Foster, it's on the players. But it's like, well, firstly, Hardy, you know, he missed the chance. And there was there's a gent who was kind enough to do a My Argyle Life for us, who sort of suggested it was an indefensible position when I put it forward on Twitter. But missing chances doesn't necessarily mean that you bear responsibility for the loss, because it's a perception bias that people seem to have. Like, if there is one chance in a game, if there's no real clear chances and there's one chance that's really like open goal and someone misses it, does that person bear responsibility for the loss? Yes, logic dictates they do. What about if there's one chance for each side? Well, then yes, you could say one guy bears responsibility for losing, for not getting the win for his team, and the other bears responsibility. What if there's five chances that are clear, like really obvious? Well, then what is it, 20% blame each? How does that work? And there becomes a point at which you have to accept that. So, for example, Hardy missed that chance. But before that chance, on 20 minutes, Borja Sainz leaves Soren Ola on his backside, breaks in the box, and he has three open men to find to tap the ball in. And he doesn't. He's so spoiled for choice, he doesn't bother. If that goes in, it's 1-1. There's also a corner where Cooper misses the ball, and Sargent has a free shot from like he's about 6 yards out. And it's either brilliant defending or fluky defending, where it just happens to come off Devine and hit the post. If he puts that shot higher, it's in the roof of the net. Then, I think like on 35 minutes, McCallum has the chance to pick someone out of the back post, doesn't. Then there's the Hardy chance. And then, as Joe said, there's also the, like, just at the start of stoppage time in the first half, where Borja Sainz again gets to the byline and misses Sargent, but could have also pulled it back to two other people who were running into the box. So the idea that if Hardy had scored that, would have been 2-0 up. Completely, like, what about those other three clear-cut chances that Norwich had? Let's say Hardy puts both of his shots away, and let's say Norwich put... Because there's also the Fashnacht header, where he misses the open goal towards the end of the second half. So they could have won, like, 6-3. That's not on Hardy. Hardy doesn't bear the responsibility for missing his shot. It's confirmation bias, it's perception bias, because we see goals and saves as absolutes, and it's the same with the defender. I've seen people saying it's on the defense, you know, because that the defending from the corners was awful. They had 13 corners. You know, I saw one tweet, and I know people are emotional in the moment after the game. He said they had four shots on target, we had four shots on target. They scored two, we scored one. That's all in that matters, and it's like, that's so reductive, it's untrue. We blocked 10 shots. They only had four shots on targets. We blocked 10 shots. We made seven tackles, 11 interceptions, 23 clearances. Norwich only had 24 defensive actions in the entire game. We had 51. So the idea that the players should have been perfect for the whole game and would have kept Norwich out is just bizarre. It's a limitation of the system that we're playing. You're expecting players who are, I mean, I'd say Galloway and Gibson are easily championship quality. But you're expecting a team which is new in the championship to defend basically a one goal. You're going to get one goal. That's what the stats say. And we've got 12 goals in the 13 league games we've played under Foster, which is almost exactly representative of those odds. We're going to get one goal a game, and we're expecting the team to either concede one or zero to get a result. That's not sustainable, and it's not logical. You know, it might have been kamikaze to play Steven Schumacher's way, but at least there was a better chance of getting a result, ironically. It was more pragmatic to go hell for leather and try and win 4-3 than it is to try and produce 3.5 shots each game and then defend against that. The thought that the players were to blame and we should have held out, that held on to that 1-0 lead, or that Ryan Hardy's misses were responsible for the loss, is just a nonsense. Because if you look at the balance of other opportunities that were in that game, the balance of statistical probability says we could have lost that game a lot more than we did. So, you know, I think actually the players did all right. I think the system functioned all right. It's a limitation of playing that system with the players we have.
It sort of reminded me, I know something that Tim Vickery said about the Brazil national team, that they beat you on moments rather than beat you on flow. And I think there's maybe a sense that, from what I gather from what you're saying, is that we're too focused on moments and not enough on the flow of the game. And we're just trying to sort of like generate those moments. And it means that the players have to be really clinical.
Yeah, because, you know, people say to me, oh, football's played on grass, not on computers. And I'm like, I completely agree. Stats are there to clarify our perception, you know? And I think like Foster's approach is almost like, well, statistically, if we do this, this will happen. And it doesn't happen that way. Moments happen, bits of individual brilliance. And in a sense, that's what Schumacher was trying to harness. Schumacher was like Morgan Whittaker, your class, Finnezas, your class, go out there and just do something brilliant because you have the ability to do it. Let's not try and win it the way everyone else plays, because we'll lose that way. Let's just be maverick and try and produce something. And I think Ian Foster's trying to apply normal football logic to a team, which, let's face it, is mostly a League One team with a couple of players that, you know, have come good that we've invested in. And he's trying to implement traditional statistical models that aren't really going to work when you're playing teams, as he says, who've bought much more expensive squads, much more experienced players, much more established players. You know, you're not playing on a level playing field when you're trying to employ those models. It seems, ironically, although it seems to be like the safer methodology, it's not in reality. Like I say, the stats will imply that you're going to get one goal. And so you either need to keep them to zero goals or one to get a point or three.
Yeah, thank you, Ben. I just want to focus a bit on Ryan Hardy, because we all know that his form has been not as good, particularly over the last five games, well, maybe more generally under Ian Foster than it was for the first half of the season. Sam, do you have any thoughts on Hardy? Why he's struggling? What maybe the manager or the system could change to help him?
Yeah, I think first and foremost, it's kind of ironic. I think his best game that he's played for us this season, and quite possibly the best game he's ever played in his whole career, was Foster's first home game against Cardiff. He was absolutely brilliant that day. He scored two goals, assisted the other, and was constantly fantastic on and off the ball. So there's a certain irony to that. I do agree that since then his form has dramatically dropped off under Ian Foster. I think he's only scored one goal since then, which is the goal at Middlesbrough. I don't think he's scored another apart. Oh, at Sunderland, he put us into the lead. So, yeah, okay. So he's still got a few goals, not as many as he did. Look, first, to answer your question, first and foremost, I do think that playing this more defensive style means he doesn't score as many goals. That's simple mathematics, I think. Even if you can argue that a defensive style is still worth playing because it improves in other areas, which I don't agree, but, you know, it's plausible that people might agree. One consequence of playing the way we do is the ball just gets to our attacking players in high areas far, far less. I think, you know, we've always said about Hardy.
Even so, there have been a lot of good chances that Hardy's missed recently. So there was, I mean, I know it was from a tight angle, an open goal against Norwich. You can point to the chance against Blackburn, the game that I was at.
So I think what I would say is, yeah, that was sort of coming on to my second point, part of that point, which is that whilst he is having fewer good chances, he is also missing those which he does have to an extent. I mean, look, like, part of it is what Ben said. It's never going to be, no player's ever going to be perfect. I think he's still, over the course of the season, converting his XG at a pretty healthy rate. But maybe just at the minute he is on a low run of confidence. We've always said on this podcast, and I'm sure many Argyle fans have said outside this podcast, Ryan Hardy is absolutely a confidence player. When he's on his full run of confidence, pretty much everything he hits appears to go in the net. When he's not on that run of confidence, you know, it can often appear as though he can't hit the proverbial barn door. But, you know, we absolutely love him when he's on form, and I'm sure that it will just take one for a goal-scoring run to start again, and hopefully that starts as of Monday. So I think it's a mixture of A, getting fewer chances to him, because, you know, in the previous days of when he had a bad goal scoring run of a dry run, we would still get him three or four chances in the game and more chances, one of them to go in. Now we're only getting one or two chances in the game. That elongates the period of time until one inevitably goes in. So it's partly the start of play, partly just natural variation. And I think partly, you know, maybe lack of confidence, lack of happiness in the system Ian Foster's asking to play, the mood around home park probably isn't the best at the moment. And for a player who is a confidence player, I dare say that the general bad vibe, bad atmosphere that appears to be around Home Park probably isn't very good for his confidence either.
And maybe
we shouldn't forget, just
running around up front on his own with no substitution every single game, chasing long balls, chasing balls into the channel. You know, he's still finishing with goals per shot and goals per shot on target better than anybody else in the team, including Morgan Whittaker, including Finn Azaz when he was here. And he's still comparable to a lot of the best and better than a lot of the best. So he's still clinical, even with the misses he's making on average this season. And I know we can say, well, that doesn't apply to the last few games necessarily, but that's what form is. You know, they're averages. You know, you're looking at the average of a season. Same, Sammy Schmodics will have missed a whole bunch of shots at some period and then put three in a row in. That's kind of just the way things work and fall. But he's under a lot of pressure, as Sam says. He's in a system that doesn't really suit him, and he's running himself into the ground. When you're tired and you try and take a, you know, everyone knows what it's like trying to take a shot after you've played an hour of football. It's not going to be as effective as the shot you took at the start of the game, 10 minutes in, when you smashed it in the top corner. And he's got possibly tired, fatigued much earlier in games because he's running around so much. So there's a physical excuse as well on this, not just on the psychological and the systemic changes and stuff.
We should just remember, very quickly, Stan, we should just remember, Ryan, you know, I mean, I've worn the tin hat about Ryan Hardy since we reignited the podcast now for well over a year, coming on to 2 years now. So I've always sort of feel like I've had to come on and defend him. And we should remember, it was only a couple of weeks ago, we were mentioning the fact he is 15th on the all-time leading goal scorers chart for this football club. It is his first year playing at this level, and he has got 13 goals. Now, I know he's been prolific in the past. He had a very good season last year. He had a good season when he came in League Two. These were all at different levels in a team that was playing with the utmost confidence all the way through. You've got to remember, when he came into that side initially under Ryan Lowe and he scored all those goals off the bench, we were flying that season for the majority of it. And he came into a side that was high on confidence and just carried on with it. It was like a snowball effect. It was the same last year. The team played with such confidence. We know Hardy's a confidence player. He fed off that. And that's why he had such a great season. Now, look, for the first part of this season, yeah, he was, you know, he was scoring fairly regularly for a bloke who was having his first season in the Championship. And I think if we were all honest about it, at the start of the year, if we'd said that Ryan Hardy would get 15 goals in the Championship this season, we'd all be pretty happy with that, really. So he's had his injury problems. He's having to overcome them. And he had injuries quickly. You know, there wasn't much of a gap between his injuries before Christmas either. It was back from an injury, bang, gets another one, he's off again. So he's been very stop-start. And I think to be on 13 goals, look, yes, he's missed big chances. He missed some goal. He missed a golden chance at Blackburn that probably would have put the game to bed a lot earlier. You know, who knows what would have happened had we gone 1-0 up that day. Yes, he missed the chances yesterday, but I just don't see... Football's a collective game. It's a team game. And whilst one player can have a bad day, it's not solely on them. And to solely pin the blame on Ryan Hardy for yesterday's defeat, I just can't associate myself with that. If that's someone's opinion, that's fine. You know, we're all entitled to our opinion. But it's a team game. I hate to use all these cliches. It's a team game. There were 16 players we used on that pitch yesterday. Everyone's complicit in that result. So we've just got to keep him on the ground, keep him level-headed. It was only 2 weeks ago we were calling for him to get a Scotland call-up. And now all of a sudden we're blaming him for a defeat. This is the fickle nature of football fans, isn't it? And he didn't have a great day yesterday. He'll admit that himself. But I would love to be sat here on Tuesday night with Aaron, with the rest of the panel, eulogising over Ryan Hardy bagging a couple and him getting the winners against Bristol City, because I just can't understand why everyone's so quick to have a go at him all the time.
Nothing gets Joe impassioned like defending Ryan Hardy.
I don't know what it is. If he's getting married and he needs somebody to give him a speech at the altar or something, I'm quite happy to step up for him. But it just irritates me how he always seems to be the whipping boy for the fan base.
I thought we were going to have our first on-air proposal there, Joe, when you said about getting married. I thought that blood is taking your appreciation of Ryan Hardy a bit too far.
We do actually have another defender of Ryan Hardy on our Facebook comments because Sandra is watching. Good evening to you. And yeah, I think we've all agreed that Hardy may be catching a little bit too much flack, and he has done a lot of good double figures goals in the championship. Not easy to get.
Picture the scene. All of your mates around, you've got your McNugget share boxes ready to go. Partner this with your team playing champagne football. Perfect. Order McDelivery now on the McDonald's app. There's nothing quite like a McDelivery. At participating restaurants, 18 plus, serving times, delivery fee and terms apply. See mcdonalds.com.
Just sort of moving on to talk about Ian Foster's post-match comments. He seemed happy with the performance. He described it as a good performance, unlucky not to get anything from the game. Two incidents he focused on with the referee. First incident was Alfie Devine, fouled, according to him, by Angus Gunn. I think certainly looking through social media, and my personal opinion is that it wasn't a foul, and the referee was correct to book him for diving. Does anyone have a contrasting view to me or the majority of fans? Go on, Joe or Sam.
Yeah, I just want to jump in with and take ref watch and then let Sam pick apart whatever I want to say. So there's a couple of things before this. I thought his eagerness to produce the yellow card towards our players, whilst yes, okay, perhaps they were, you know, I thought two or three of them might have been borderline in the first half, but he seemed very quick and eager to get the yellow card out. And that was a bit frustrating. As for the penalty, look, at full speed, I was sat on the sofa, I was watching it on Argyle TV. At full speed, I leant forward because I was assuming I was about to jump up out of my seat and get ready to celebrate a penalty. When he blew his whistle, I was very excited, and then I saw him point the other way and I could not believe it. Then I see the replay and there are three decisions that the referee can make in this situation. Number one is he awards the penalty. Number two is he waves it away and just lets play carry on. Number three, he books him for simulation. The one decision he chose to give is the one I simply cannot fathom, because I don't understand how you can possibly book him for diving. Now, look, I've messaged two qualified referees. I put this out on a post on X earlier today to get their reaction to it. Both of them have said that it's not a penalty. So I don't imagine that Foster will be adding to his list of apologies from the PGMOL next week when he opens up his emails. One of them says it's probably borderline a yellow card. One of them doesn't really mention a yellow card for simulation. I just can't believe he's booked him for simulation. I really can't. Yes, okay, perhaps Devine leaves a leg there and he sees the challenge coming. But it's not a dive. We see dives every week in the Premier League. That isn't a dive. And you can't blame that for the result. I know Foster's looking for things to cling on. But it's just becoming a little bit frustrating. I suppose maybe it's because we've been used to the last two managers not really coming out and publicly chastising referees, if you like, for their decisions. I know it's something that Neil Jusnip was quite happy to do after the Southampton debacle, when he came out and was pretty seething that night. But I just thought it was a little bit of clutching at straws territory from Fozzie to say that that was an incident that really cost us. Yes, okay, if the referee gives it, we get back into it. But the way I look at these subjective decisions is, if that's at the other end, how do I feel about it? And if that's at the other end, I am launching anything within 6 feet around me on the sofa at the television, and I'm saying some very un-Easter weekend Jesus resurrection words. I think the referee had three decisions to make, and I don't think he made the right one. I do think he made the right one, because I don't think it's a penalty, but I don't think he made the right one in booking Devine with a yellow card, personally. I think that was a bit harsh.
I'm going to go and...
Go on.
There you go. I was just going to say, I disagree. I think it's a yellow card dive.
Well, maybe you can disagree with me then rather than Joe, because I'm actually, because Joe's taking the middle of the three positions. I'm going to actually go, we've got all three positions represented here, because I'm going to actually go even more strongly. I think it was absolutely a penalty kick, and I think Ian Foster is correct. Come again?
I think you might be in a minority of one.
Well, yeah, just me and my mate Ian. I don't agree with a lot of what Ian Foster said in the interviews, and I do think it is getting a little bit tiring hearing him, you know, berate the referee as much as he does. Certainly, I think his view on the Gibson incident was sour grapes, because Mike Cooper definitely does beckon him on, by the way, clear as day he does.
Yeah.
We'll get to that. But the Devine incident, rather, I do think it was a penalty. Look, I try not to let anything fit a pre-existing agenda I've got. I try and judge each thing on its own merits. And I think, looking at it now, Alfie Devine is not under any obligation to move out of the way of the keeper. If he initiates contact towards the keeper, that's a different matter. But I don't think he does. I think if you watch it in slow motion, he makes a very small leftwards motion away from the keeper, away from goal, as he goes to run through. And I think that leftwards motion, to me, absolutely takes out of the equation the idea that he's actively looking for that foul. I think he's trying to avoid the keeper. I think he's trying to sort of take it round the keeper, or you know, certainly get the ball past the keeper. And he gets the ball past the keeper, and I think the keeper does catch him. It's not a lot of contact, but when you're going at full speed, not a lot of contact, it can still be enough to send you flying. And I think that's what's happened. I think it is a penalty, not a popular opinion, and that doesn't defend how badly we're doing in the league. It doesn't defend how badly Ian Foster's doing, but I do think it was a penalty kick. And I think as a result of that, we have got a bit unlucky in that regard. Certainly, I don't think it's a dive, because I think even if you think that Foster initiates contact towards the keeper, which, I don't think he did.
Initiated contact towards the keeper.
He makes like a double, like an extension with his leg to get the contact. I don't think you can claim that. I mean, and you can say, well, maybe that was just a, but his leg is in a quite an unnatural position to draw that contact. His leg is like, when you are running, it is very rare for your leg to be straight. It's straight for when it's in front of you and you're about to make a stride. For his leg to be straight at that moment is a conscious action. And I think that implies that he's drawn the contact. Now, you can argue he's entitled to draw the contact. He's entitled to put his leg there. But for me, it's never a penalty. You can't use the law on tripping. For if someone has drawn the contact, the tripping must have been a conscious action by the fouling person on the foulee, whatever the terminology is. It's never a penalty for me.
One last thing before we move on from the penalty debate, I do wonder if this is perhaps a direct consequence of how, without trying to sound like a football dinosaur, the direct consequence of just how top flight football in particular has gone over the last few years, in that Alfie Devine's a young man, so he'd have watched a lot of top flight football, not just in England, but all around Europe. And these sorts of incidents happen on a weekly basis in major leagues up and down over Europe. And you see VAR giving penalties for this, where there is the slightest contact on players in and around the box. And, you know, as Sam says, he's no right to stay on his feet. If he feels there's contact, he's every entitlement to go to ground. And, you know, he clearly was aghast that he'd been booked for diving. But my gut feeling is that the referee got the decision right not to award the penalty, but he's not got it right to award the yellow card. One thing that should be said, regardless of everything, it is a bit rash from Angus Gunn. To come steaming out like that and put himself in the position where he could legitimately clatter into Devine. But, you know, he's got away with it and Norwich went on to win the game. But
I think what you can say is if it had been given and there was VAR, I don't think VAR would have overturned it. And that's, you know, because there is contact. So I think that, you know, that's where that grey area is. You're mentioning, Joe, about, you know, what you see in the top
flight. Thank God there isn't VAR.
Maybe we'll have our own VAR and sort of analyse the film in depth, like it's the Zapruder film. That'll be a sort of Argyle Life end of season content right there, I think.
Are you going to do a watch, Joe? Because if not, I'll have my say. But if you do it better than I do, and you're obviously better at it than I am. But I just thought the ref was appalling. Like, Barnes kicked Miller in the face and then left a massive chunk on Galloway. Didn't get a booking. Pleguezuelo comes on, gets booked for his first sort of body check. You know, was it Miller got
was
a card?
There was the other moment where Miller got booked for.
Yeah, exactly.
Was it Stacey yeah, pulled back on the right side? And then second half, they had a player do potentially even worse on Sorinola, and there was nothing given. So it was just, again, this, Ben, we mention it all the time in our group chat, and I've mentioned it on this podcast before. It just comes back to consistency with referees.
Yeah.
Consistency on picking up the decisions and giving the fouls and the yellow cards where it's applicable. And the one thing that is glaringly obvious, I mean, we've had to put up with League Two referees now for 10, 12, 13 years. I thought the step up to the Championship would see an improvement in the standard of refereeing. Personally, I've not seen that, hence why there's a popular ref watch segment on this podcast every week. You know, maybe Keith Stroud will roll back the years on Monday and give us a vintage refereeing performance. Somehow I doubt it, but you never know. So it was a disappointing performance, but the referee hasn't stopped us picking up runners and the smallest man on the pitch from two set pieces. So that's just a really frustrating thing. You know, we all want to find reasons why we don't win, but whilst I understand the dressing room might feel hurt by a couple of decisions, it's not directly cost us the game, in my opinion.
I agree with that. We've talked about the penalty, but also this other incident that Foster was referring to with the physio. Sam, did you have a few thoughts on that?
Yeah, so the crux of Ian Foster's objection appears to be that the physio should not have been called on, and as such, Gibson shouldn't have had to leave the pitch, and therefore we'd have had an extra man on to defend that set piece. That's his core objection. I think there's a few points I'd raise to that. Firstly, that Foster's claiming that Michael Cooper never called the physio on. Yes, he did. Ian, he may have told you he never called the physio on, but trust me, we've all seen the video he did. He clearly beckoned him on. He then did, you know, almost put his hand up to say, actually, no, he's okay. But that doesn't change the fact that at first he beckoned him on. Foster's second sort of point within that is that even if Cooper did beckon him on, the referee should have assessed him first. Again, I also don't agree on that because player safety is paramount. If there's any doubt at all about the safety of that player, you know, if you're the referee, you don't then wait for, let me go and have a look and I'll see, and then I'll beckon the physio on. No, if the goalkeeper's beckoned him on, which he has, then you let the physio come on because head injuries are too important to be, you know, messing about with.
Sam, I am just going to cut you off because Mr. Bell looks like he's about to have a mental breakdown or something. So, Joe, do you have any thoughts on what Sam's just said?
If that's the case, the referee can take a player's word for it that a player needs treatment and he doesn't need to assess him himself. Maybe that's why Wickham games tend to see 12, 13 minutes added on every week. You'd have players going down and faking injuries all the time and then just other players beckoning the physio on. The referee has to assess the player.
I can't
Michael Cooper's word for verbatim.
I think head injuries are different because head injuries are so associated with safety and so associated with a higher risk of welfare.
What did you think about the incident in the Newcastle West Ham game today then when Fabian Scher went down?
I didn't actually see that, to be honest with you. I didn't realise
we had Arsene Wenger with us this evening.
If you saw my big coat yesterday, I did watch the game. I was out of the room for that moment.
The crucial thing in this moment was it was Cooper himself who punched him in the head, then went to look at him, then looked up at the bench and beckoned. And I think as a referee, yes, he ought to have gone and checked. But I can understand in human nature the error he has made to assume that Cooper has in good faith thought this might be a serious injury and not delayed the 10 seconds it would have taken him to get over there and look. Still a mistake, and also still isn't directly contributory to the goal that follows. But I can kind of see where he's coming from. Doesn't mean that it wasn't his job to go and and take the extra 5 seconds to check. It's not likely that he was going to die because of the 5-10 second delay would have taken him to go.
Okay.
So
okay.
I understand.
You know what? Argument? You know what? I'll admit when I'm wrong. I think you've both made a fair point. Maybe the referee could and should have gone over and checked. It wouldn't have added much more than a few seconds on. And I think as someone in the comments so kindly told me that I don't know the protocols. I think, yes, if we're being brutally accurate to the protocols, now I think about it, I think they do actually, thinking back on it, say something about referee assessment. So I will admit that you two are probably right that the referee should have gone over and checked, actually. But, you know, the best of people admit when they're wrong if a valid argument is presented to them. And I think I probably have been presented with a valid counter-argument. That being said, once the video has then come over, he does then have to go off. That is also within the rules. If the physio goes on the pitch, the player has to go off. Is that always 100% applied for consistency? No, it isn't always. But when the physio, the directives are, when the physio comes on, the player has to go off. And that much I definitely do know the directives about. So is it unfortunate? Yes, it absolutely is.
By the comments here, this is why I'd never read them about me.
Yeah.
let's be fair, those extra few seconds the referee could have taken in examining Gibson, he probably wouldn't have added on at the end anyway. But the bigger point I was going to make is, in that situation where Michael Cooper's the first one on the scene, because essentially it's him who's come to punch the ball and clattered into Gibson, it's no fault of Cooper's, he's doing what he's allowed to do and what he should do, is it not Michael Cooper to go down and ask Lewis Gibson, do you need the physio? And if Gibson says no, give me 5 seconds, then Cooper can tell the referee, no, he's all right, ref, he doesn't need treatment, let's just carry on, just give him a bit of time to get up. We see it every week that happens. Referees give players 10, 15 seconds to get on their feet. Why has that not happened here? Where's the break? That there's somewhere along the way, there's been a breakdown between Gibson going to ground, Cooper ushering on the physio and then pointing it out to the referee. The referee not inspecting Gibson himself to see if he needs the treatment. And then the farcical situation of Joe Edwards pushing the physio off the pitch, telling him not to show the referee that he's entered the field of play. It was all very like Keystone Cops, you know, get him out of shot. Hope the referee doesn't see him so he doesn't have to go off. But somewhere along the way there was definitely a breakdown that led to Gibson being off the field for that corner. Is Gibson really going to be the one to pick up that man? Who knows? Would it have made a huge amount of difference? Ifs and buts. What was it I saw Scott Lindsay, the Crawley manager, say on social media earlier? If my auntie had wheels, she'd be a shopping trolley. So it's all ifs and buts, and you just got to move on as tough as it is.
Yeah, I think at the end of the day, whether you blame the referee for not checking, whether you blame Cooper for being so rushed with it, whether you just think it's a bad bit of luck, Gibson was up, he was ready to come back on. All we had to do was defend that first bit of play. Gibson would have probably been waved back on. All we had to do was defend that first bit of play, and we didn't. We had two players near the zone where it fell to, in Houghton and Sousa. One of them should have picked it up. We didn't. And if we can clear that first ball, either get it out for a throw-in, get it out for another corner, or even just get it out of the box, Gibson probably gets waved back on in quite short order. So did we get unlucky? Yeah, we absolutely did. Is that the reason we lost the game? Absolutely not.
I've had a lot of sympathy for Ian Foster for a lot of reasons. He's been thrown into a very difficult situation in his first job. But those comments really drained a lot because both of those comments were borderline. Jack, stop making comments like that because I can't help but read them. Both of those comments were borderline delusion, or he's got absolute brass neck to say that with a straight face. And in either instance, he's mugging off the fans. And the other thing he said was that we should have finished our chances and that would have made a difference. And he's hanging Ryan Hardy out to dry. Basically, we all know what he's talking about. And that is completely out of order. And Ryan Hardy put in perhaps the individual performance of the season to secure the win against Cardiff earlier in the season and sort of get his regime up and running. I think Hardy scored 4 or 5 goals in the 13 games he's been in. It's probably a better run for Foster than he had for Schumacher when you look at the goals per games. So I thought that was really unfair. And really unkind, and sort of loading into the fact, he's saying, oh, I wish I'll take all the hits and then he's hanging his player out to dry for the fans to take a pop at. Thought that was really out of order. And, you know, and sort of saying, oh, we had a really good game, we'd have, you know, if we'd taken our chances, we'd have won. I looked at, like, I did some stats on Schumacher's away games, which apparently were awful, yeah, and compared them to this. Let's run through a few. You might not rate all of these stats. We had 35% possession against Norwich. In only two away games did we have less under Shuey, Hull away and QPR when we were down to 10 men. Shot accuracy, only twice.
Hang on a minute. I was at Elland Road. We did not have 35% or more percent of the possession, surely.
40% of possession. And not only do we have 40% possession, we made 342 accurate passes, whereas yesterday we made 231. We've only made less accurate passes twice, once against Watford away, once again against QPR. We had 9 shots. Only twice have we had less than 9 shots away under Schumacher. Bristol City and West Brom, both of which we know are tragic attacking performances. 4 shots on target. Only twice have we had less than that away under Schumacher. Bristol City again and West Brom again. Again, 2 tragic attacking performances. XG against, only twice have we conceded more XG against. Leicester away and Birmingham away, strangely. 23 shots against, only the QPR game when we were down to 10 men did we concede more than the 23 shots against we faced yesterday. And 14 shots in the box, only against QPR away under Schumacher did we concede more when we conceded 17 shots in the box. So the idea that this was a stellar away performance, and that, you know, and fans are sort of on it because we've been so dire recently, the recency bias is affecting people. They're like, that was really good. And it was a good, you know, I thought the players did play well. I said it, you know, I thought they did as well as they could under the instructions they've been given to go out and perform.
But I'm just
it wasn't like an amazing performance that sort of shattered the previous away performances that we'd been putting in.
Bring up very quickly, sort of on your point, is something from Dave Searle on X, formerly Twitter. And he says, did anyone expect us to get a result yesterday? No. Damage limitation. Our goal difference is worth a point.
Yeah.
So, wasn't a bad result.
I said that in the in my intro. We played as well as we could be expected in this system, and we got beaten by a better team with better players, more expensive squad, and there's no shame in that. Absolutely not. And I said before you guys did the I don't know if anyone here was on it, actually, the Norwich preview. Joe, when you were hosting the previous live, we did a quick assessment of Norwich prediction. I said we'd lose 2-0 and be grateful it was only 2. And the fact that we came away 2-1, you know, that's actually better than I was expecting and a decent result. I don't think, like as has been said, these aren't necessarily the games that we should be focusing on. But then I go back to the point that, well, we went away to West Brom and got a point. We went away to Hull and got a point. We beat Norwich 6-2 at home. So we have the ability, if we play the correct system and employ the strengths of the players correctly, to make these games our fight. The reason they're not our fight currently is because we're employing a system which handicaps us against teams. We're playing a very similar style of football to you'd expect the top-end teams to be playing, which works if you're England at an under-18s, under-20 tournament because you have the best players in the tournament. Doesn't work if you have a lower end of the competition squad. That's what's inhibiting us, is not playing to the strength of our players and getting the most out of them. It's the limitations of the system.
Sam, do you fully agree about yesterday with the stats? I mean, you could certainly argue that was that what matters? 2 away wins under Foster, 0 under Schumacher.
No, I don't, because I think that's a little bit of a stat that doesn't quite reflect the how we've played. I think ultimately Swansea was a euphoric feeling to be coming out of there finally with an away win, singing and chanting. But ultimately, probably the main difference in the Swansea game compared to a lot of the other games is the finishing of the home side. They had a lot of chances and didn't really put them away. I'm not going to say that was a dreadful performance from us, but it wasn't a performance that was more worthy of a win than any of the others. And if Charlie Patino had his shooting boots on, that would have been last-minute heartbreak. Middlesbrough, we were very good at Middlesbrough. But also they gifted it to us a little bit of the way they played defensively. So, look, overall, Foster have managed to get two wins with Schumacher away from home, with Schumacher got none. And I've got to respect that to an extent. Yeah, ATID in the comments says we got destroyed by Swansea, other than their strikers being shocking. I think destroyed is maybe a little bit too far the other way, but I certainly wouldn't agree we were great value for the win. I would agree with ATID on that.
Swansea produced 2.77 XG in that game and less than one XG on target.
There so we go.
Absolutely honking in front
terrible
of
terrible terrible finishing, yeah.
If they got anything close to even half of what they ought to, they'd have beat us.
I agree. And or at least drawn. So yeah, I agree. And ultimately with that, Middlesbrough was a very good performance, no taking away from it, but it was also probably, from what their fans all seem to say, the worst they've played all season. We got a bit lucky that such a shocking Middlesbrough implosion happened to happen against us. So, look, Foster has got two away wins. Schumacher got none. I'm not going to take that away from him. But I do think our general standard of performance away from home was better under Schumacher. And Schumacher had some games where the luck very much went against him, Ipswich certainly being the main one that comes to my mind. The away win, absolutely. And, well, Coventry, yeah, that obviously that ball overhanging the line was quite borderline. Don't mind me, I'm just, yeah, coughing and spluttering.
Saints for Dewsnip.
Southampton for Dewsnip, yeah. So the first away win, as much as it felt like a great hallowed achievement, Cardiff with that Matt Butcher own goal fiasco. So, yeah, as much as the first away win felt euphoric and felt like, you know, wow, Foster's finally found the magic formula nobody else has, I don't necessarily think that's the case. I think his formula isn't inherently better for away games than Schumacher or Dewsnip's. He's just had a little bit more luck and a little bit slightly better execution go his way. That the other two never quite did. And I think how bad we've been away from home in other games has unfortunately solidified that point. I do think Foster is better at coaching away games than he himself is at coaching home games. I think that's undisputable because our home form under him is honking. But do I think he's this fantastic away coach? No, I don't. I still think a lot of his flaws get shown up even in away games, like how deep we sat, like how we collapsed mentally after 1-1 to then lose 2-1. So I don't think that the away form is in any way going to let Ian Foster off the hook for how bad we've become under him in general, would be my take on that.
And just to quickly add, apart from Norwich, the average league position before this set of games just gone of our away opponents was 16.5. You know, and include it, you know, it's Blackburn, Wednesday, etc. And we didn't get points out of those. So it's kind of like, well, those are the games we should have been getting points out of. Beating Borough is great, but then you'll go and get 1 point out of Wednesday and Blackburn. It doesn't really make much of a difference. Yes, it's great that you got those, but we were looking forward to those away results, finally thinking, oh, when we get to Wednesday away, Rotherham away, that's when, you know, Schumacher will get his first away win. So that's kind of the results we were, not the results, but the fixtures we were expecting to start picking up a couple of away wins this season in anyway. So I don't see it as I don't necessarily think that if Schumacher was still here, he wouldn't have got potentially his first win within this period of time that we've had with Foster anyway. So I know that's ifs and buts and suppositions, but, you know, we've played some honking teams away and he's got two away wins. You know, that's pretty, you know, to be, you'd like to think that should be expected.
Should we just take a few questions from socials before maybe moving on to having a look at Bristol City on Monday? Sam, this might be best for you. Zach on Twitter asks, what was the atmosphere like? Any he's got to go or otherwise anti-Foster chanting?
Certainly not during the game, no. And I think, I think rightly not during the game, because I think we can put, when we were putting some decent attacking play together, which, for all I agree with Ben about, you know, it wasn't the most amazing performance, there were some good attacking moments. We'd be churlish to deny that. So whilst we were having a bit of a go, I think it would have been, you know, maybe not the most appropriate thing to start Foster chanting during that time. So during the game, I think everyone behaved themselves and got behind the team. The one really disheartening moment was at full time, and not even disheartening in the sense that it wasn't justified. Just it's sad to see such a disconnect between the head coach and the club. But at full time, there were a few sort of boos at full time whistle, just in frustration and anger. You know, that in itself is fairly par for the course. But then when the players came over, everybody who was then booing clapped the players because they appreciated the players came over. They appreciated that they were coming over the front up and thank us for our support, and in turn we thanked them by clapping them. And then Ian Foster himself sort of wanders over, and there's a loud sort of boo as he comes up. And they're almost like in a pantomime or whatever, when the villain steps on and there's a big boo, just literally when he stepped onto the pitch almost is when it happened.
I would say he's behind you, but he's probably shorter than a lot of the players, so you wouldn't be able to see him, would you?
Well, unfortunately, he was behind a lot of the players, probably because of that very fact that the further forward he got, the more he got booed, unfortunately. So he was actually behind them, as it goes. And look, people, you know, I'm not going to say anybody, certainly not after the game was finished, I'm not going to say anybody who's paid all that money, got up at stupid o'clock to travel up to Norfolk to watch the game is in any way wrong for reacting a certain way. But it just, to me, after the euphoria of last May, after the adventurous, fearless spirit of September, October, November, how united we were, how happy we were as a group of fans, even as recently as January deadline day, we were all delighted that Whittaker had stayed. We were talking about the togetherness, the feel-good factor that Whittaker has with this club. Thinking back to how recent all of those happy moments were, to now be of that level of crisis whereby even when the head coach walks towards us, there are loud, widespread boos, is a bit of a stark and sobering reflection on where we're actually at as a club and how much I think he has completely lost the faith and lost the confidence of the fans. I think it will be almost impossible for him to restore that relationship with the fans. I'm not going to say almost, because... just to quickly finish off that point, I'm not going to say almost, because if we won every game and started next season, great, of course he would. But if we become a team, we win a couple, lose a couple, I think it's at the stage now where he's so disliked, then that will always be willing to come to the surface again after a couple of bad results. And I think that's sad.
I just want to point to a question that we've had in from PFC Matt on YouTube. If we lose on Monday, does the board get rid of Foster or just accept our fate? Ben, what do you think? Is the atmosphere as toxic as Sam's saying, in your opinion?
It's not just toxic amongst us. Like, I went on a pod, I don't know if it's on the Argyle Life or the Green and White podcast or not. I went on a round table with the seven of the other bottom eight teams, or seven of us bottom eight teams, just before this round of fixtures. And predicted who of us would go down. We had four votes for Argyle, even though we had at least goal difference, if not points advantage, on everyone. And one of them specifically said that's predicated on you not changing your manager. Yesterday, we had tweets, people from other championship clubs retweeting his interview saying, goodness me, no wonder Argyle fans want rid of him. If like a whole fan saying, if Rosinha came out and said this stuff, I'd be absolutely livid. So it's not just our fans being precious. Oh, we love chewy ball. We want attacking football. Fans of football are looking at us and being like, you know, for half a season, our biggest gripe was people saying, wow, you play brilliant football. You're not going to go down. It's a breath of fresh air. Now people are looking at us and saying, you absolutely stink. You're my favourites to go down. So it's not just us being, like I say, precious or sort of, you know, being delicate. But as to the question, will the board get rid of him? That board haven't even come out, or the club haven't even come out and made a comment like to give him his backing. I think there's two possible reasons why that is. One, it's to leave things open so that if we lose, for example, against Bristol City and then they don't sack him maybe, or then we lose against Rotherham, it's like, well, okay, now we need to make a decision. So not giving him your backing, but also not saying anything about, you know, sacking him or whatever. It gives you all options, leaves you open to all options as a board, doesn't it? Whereas if you come out and give him your back in and then decide, actually, crumbs, we've just lost three in a row, we need to try desperately to stay up, then we can't sack him. But I think that the second option is more likely, that the club are just saying, well, we've got to ride it out. There's no guarantees that if we swap him, that whoever comes in, whether it's a temporary appointment from inside, whether it's a firefighter, whether it's we, you know, go back for one of the candidates which we rejected, there's no guarantees that we'll improve. So I genuinely believe the club are just going to say, we're going to, you know, stick with him. I genuinely think that's the feel, and that's not what I think most fans want to hear. It certainly doesn't appear to be the most sensible option. but I think that logically, as a business decision, it probably makes the most sense to do, even if from a footballing point of view, it seems like suicide.
But then from a business sense, the thing that the thing that makes the most the thing that makes the most sense out of anything is to stay in this division. We've all done the basic, you know, cigarette packet mathematics. For the TV deal alone is about 8 million. For the higher solidarity payments in the Premier League is about 4 million. That's 12 million tangible English pounds as a result of staying up. That's not to mention the fact that we have far higher negotiating power for Whittaker if we stay up, far higher negotiating power for other players if we stay up, far more likely that we'll get a full house of season ticket renewals if we stay up. Staying up is probably worth about 15 million pounds to this club. Sacking Ian Foster, if that's what we deem to give us the best chance of staying up, that's not even going to be 5% of that. It's probably not even going to be 3 or 4% of that.
You're preaching to the choir here, but my counter argument for that is like it's exactly what I just said. Sacking him doesn't guarantee. It might increase your chances, but it doesn't guarantee survival. So effectively, you may have just incurred another cost and go down anyway. So, you know, either Thomas Kravis. So, you know, I totally agree. And I think that sacking him is the right choice. Bring in someone, whoever it might be. Warnock, give it Nance till end of season. Whatever you're, you know, I think just getting the crowd back on side and doing that is potentially the... But I think it's because you're not able to guarantee. If they could guarantee, as you know, that's what his business is, isn't it? The chairman, the owner, he's a risk assessor. And if he thinks there's enough of a guarantee or enough of a percentage chance in the sacking bringing about survival, he'd do it. I just don't think he's convinced in the percentage, you know, the maths teacher might be able to give a better explanation of this, but I don't think he's convinced of the full, you know, but, you know, if I sack him, we're definitely going to stay up. That's definitely going to solve our problems. And that, I think all your arguments are completely valid. And I think all the fans would agree with you. I think the chairman and perhaps some of the other rest of the board are seeing it from a slightly different angle, which,
yeah,
whether it's right or wrong is it will be proved, I suppose.
Well, they're making an enormous gamble. They're making an enormous gamble. It's like in, you know, philosophy, you look at the trolley problem of do you pull the lever? And ultimately, I won't go too far into it, but the moral of that story is that not pulling the lever is a choice in and of itself. And it's a choice that will very much backfire, I fear, if we don't sack him before the end of the season. I really struggle to see how we're going to stay up with, if he stays. You know, of course, we might do. We could just get a bit of a lucky win like Swansea was and then get a, you know, convincing win against Rotherham because they're awful and all of a sudden we're on 6 points out of the next two. I certainly would rule that scenario out. But I think if we don't sack him, I think we're going more likely than not. Not certainly, because funny results do happen and nothing's ever certain in football. But if we don't sack him, I think we're far more likely than not to go down. I think even in a better performance, which yesterday definitely was a better performance, it still wasn't good enough. It still had some pretty big holes. And let's be honest, are we expecting us to take that renewed positive performance into the Bristol City game? I know I'm not. I'm expecting it to be back to the sort of drab form of the past few home games. And I hope I'm wrong. If we come out there like a train and batter Bristol City and take an early lead, I'll be delighted. And I think Oak Park will be rocking if that happens. But I don't think it's going to happen for one moment. I think we'll maybe get a draw, but I certainly don't think we'll win. And that's why I think the board are playing an incredibly dangerous game in not sacking Ian Foster. But hopefully, whatever happens, we'll stay up. You know, whether we stay up with Foster or stay up without Foster, staying up is absolutely crucial. And I just really hope we do, because I loved, you know, I'm loving Carrow Road. I'm loving all these places away from home, Ellen Road, Leicester, you know, Southampton. I'm not really ready to go back to Burton in Cambridge. I don't know about you lot. I'm sure following a football club like we do is cyclical, and we will have a cycle of being back in the lower leagues, but I'm not ready for that yet. After 1 year, I don't think anyone else really is. And it's seemingly pretty miserable to me that it's looking like we're going to, and I don't really know where I'm going at this point rather than rambling into a cul-de-sac, so I'll put myself back on mute and let Stan move on to his next question.
The other important point about whether he gets the sack after Bristol City or not, or say, let's say Rotherham, is that the fan base has already lost. The time to do it has passed, it seems, in most people's opinion. And so if they'd done it during the international break and brought someone in, and then we'd still gone down, people would say, well, at least the board tried. You know, they listened to the fans, they saw the writing was on the wall and they tried. It didn't work, but fair enough. Whereas if they do it after Bristol City or Rotherham and then we still go down, I think the fans will not be as forgiving. And they'll have said, you should have done it earlier. You know, we were trying to tell you that you could see the facts and the stats and the evidence with your eyes on the pitch. You should have done something earlier. And that goodwill that's been generated will have been a lot of that goodwill and trust in the club doing good business. I think will have been lost amongst the fan base.
Just another question coming in from Justa Janna on YouTube. Talking about Foster's use of substitutions, which I know, something that I've been quite critical of, I think, among many fans. Why does Foster always sub Sorinola halfway? He set up Whittaker for his goal and he's always getting stuck in. Foster is wasting Sorinola's potential. Do you agree with that idea that Foster's wasting Sorinola's potential and he should be playing more?
I'm a little bit surprised. He seems to get cramp a lot, my overriding feeling about it. He runs, you know, I'm not doubting his work rate at all. I think he works tremendously hard when he is in the side because, you know, essentially he has a point to prove. You know, he was released from Union Saint-Gilloise over in Belgium. And, you know, he does have a point to prove after a pretty good spell at Swansea, it has to be said, before that. And where else was it? Milton Keynes Dons, wasn't it? He was there as well. So, you know, he's trying to continue his development as a footballer. But yeah, I mean, at the moment, for whatever reason regarding his fitness, since he's come into the football club, he hits a brick wall after about 65, 70 minutes, and therefore he has to come off. You know, he's playing, the fullbacks are almost on a rotation basis every other game at the moment. So it's not as if he's suddenly come back into the side after 8 games on the bench without getting minutes. So it is a bit of a surprising one. Look, I thought he was a very good threat going forward on that right yesterday. I think at times he was beaten far too easily on the defensive aspect of his performance on that right side. But the one thing you can guarantee with Matty Sorinola is that you're going to get 110% out of him every time he steps onto that pitch.
That's a maths teacher. You know. I must disagree with that, I'm afraid.
but he's going to give you everything he's got. He's always going to empty his reserves, no matter what the situation that the team find themselves in. So we're going to need players like that over the course of the next 7 games. You know, we'll come on to it in a bit when we touch on the Bristol City game, whether or not I expect him to start on Monday. But to answer the question that came in, the reason he came off in this game, and I'd imagine most games, is just because of a fitness thing where he hits a wall after a certain period. And look, we've got him under contract for next season, regardless of what division we're in. So with a full summer's pre-season under his belt, I'm sure, you know, whatever he... It's almost like... you know, one of my other passions, as people follow me on Twitter will know, is horse racing. And we have there's a saying that goes around in horse racing, whatever they do this season is a bonus. It's next season that you're looking at. And I just wonder whether Sorinola next year, with a summer at grass, to use another racing term, whether or not he'll be a different proposition next year with that full pre-season under his belt. So it's just a case of minding him, I think, between now and the summer, and hoping that next year any problems he's had, because we don't know what issues he came with. He may well have had an injury, hence leaving Union Saint-Gilloise. So, you know, we'll just have to assess him after the summer. But I think he's doing a decent job. And look, if you can get a good 70 minutes out of a fullback, I think you're gonna be pretty happy, given that we've got some decent fullbacks at the football club, albeit it seems a couple of them can't go longer than 70 minutes before their legs give up the ghost.
I really enjoyed your pronunciation of Saint-Gilloise as well. Very authentic. Sorinola, I've been quite impressed with him.
I think he's a decent player. I think he's probably the pick of the January signings, which isn't the highest bar in the world, to be truthful. But I think he's probably the pick of the January signings. Not without his flaws. I think he It sometimes doesn't get forward quite enough, or that's probably more the fault of the tactics and the coaching. When he does get forward, his end product is decent. It's not, you know, not amazing. There are a few duff crosses in there, but it's solid enough. He's energetic when he's on, possibly almost too energetic, and he runs out of energy because he's ran up and down so well. So, yeah, look, I think what Joe said, next season you make him into his own a bit more. But he's got a lot of good attributes to him, and I do think he is in our strongest team at the minute, because I think Joe Edwards is not up to it at championship level for all his fantastic effort. I think Barley Mumba is far more suited to the left-hand side than the right, as much as Ian Foster seems to disagree. So I do think Soren Ola is in our best 11 at the moment. And whilst he is not exactly an amazing championship player based on what we've seen yet, I think he's certainly a capable one. And I think his attitude, his mindset, his energy levels, his persona very much endear him to the Argyle fans. And I think it's become a bit of a fan favourite already, which is quite hard to do given we've been losing every week.
And another question we've just had, coming in from Jack, sort of related to Ian Foster's use of subs, Jack on X. With the bench yesterday needing a goal, why bring Wayne on and then use him as a winger? I personally thought that was a bit bizarre. I don't really understand why it wasn't Mustapha Bundu personally.
Yeah. Or even bring Bundu and Wayne on and put Wayne up front because Hardy's knackered, and put Mustapha Bundu on the left, or even the other way around, because Wayne has shown he can sort of work the little man, big man routine. But it was just weird to, I think the substitutions are, I didn't have a problem with the sort of the injury substitution. Soren Ola came off, didn't he? And then Randall came off for sure, because they seemed to be, it was either cramping or struggling in another way. But some of the other substitutions were a bit bizarre. It's the one thing I think.
Don't forget Rans was on a booking as well. And it was getting, Norwich was stretching our midfield, and there was every chance, tactical fouls might have come into it at some point.
Yeah, I've got no problem with those substitutions. And I think even the next wave, I think, Joe coming on, Edwards, I couldn't remember his first surname for some reason. We know that the wing backs go up and down. It tires them out. We've become accustomed to the traditional 70-minute exchange, if not earlier. So I think, that was those. But yeah, that last, it was all a bit weird. Even bringing Pleggy on, and Pleggy didn't, if anything, he seemed to stymie the game a little, which isn't necessarily the manager's fault, but it just seemed a strange. I know that Phillips is probably, again, somebody put his hand up and said, I'm tired, but Pleggy didn't seem to, it all seemed a little bit formulaic, I don't know if it's the right word, but it all seemed a little bit predetermined in a way. And part of the reason we're so keen to blame Hardy is because, Wayne coming on, no one's expecting him to score. You sort of think, I think some people are thinking, if Hardy doesn't score, where are we getting the goals from? We've got two other forwards on the bench to use. And why the fact that we're all going, rolling our eyes that Ben Wayne's coming on, I think says everything about how we've assessed his qualities. My biggest gripe is how often he hits the target. He doesn't hit the target often enough. I mean, and it's all well and good he can run around and be energetic. And he's had some good games where he's, made a nuisance of himself and pressed. But, bringing him on the left where it's not, he struggles enough up front, which is his main position. So to bring him on the left where he's not really played for us at all seemed baffling. If anything, if you wanted to bring him on in his position and give him a chance. Seemed a bit desperate. And maybe we have been spoiled that, that Schumacher was such an excellent game manager, but I don't think those were even up to average standard of game control from Foster yesterday.
Yeah, I agree. I've sort of noticed how poor a lot of Ian Foster's in-game management is from my perspective. There's a game that I've started playing with some of the people that I go to the football with. Sam's one of them, actually, which is the Ian Foster double wing back substitute bingo or sweepstake, in which we predict the minute in which Ian Foster will substitute both of his wing backs. So I think that very much follows on from your point, Ben, that a lot of his substitutions do feel like they are premeditated.
in his defence yesterday, the two wing-backs that he changed were both on bookings, and obviously Miller and Sorinola, it seems at the moment, particularly Sorinola at the moment with his cramping up and things, and Miller with his pretty patchy injury record in the past, perhaps that's why they both came off yesterday. I would suspect it's more the fact they're on bookings and James Lindington was giving out yellow cards like they were business cards yesterday. But
Miller's addiction to a crazy tackle probably influenced that as much.
For once, I was willing to give Fozzie a pass on actually changing the wing backs whenever he saw fit. If he wanted to do it at half time, then he had my full support.
Well, I actually, as somebody who on many occasions on this podcast has gone on record and said that Mikel Miller is not as good as our fans seem to think he is, I actually thought he had an all right game yesterday. I thought he got some good crosses into the box on a couple of occasions. I thought he progressed the ball up the pitch quite nicely. He wasn't quite, I think the headless chicken he sometimes can be. I think maybe he did a little bit less in terms of showing for the ball, but less is actually more in terms of his progression and outcome. So I actually think he had an okay game, actually, Miller, which I don't always say, but I would say yes.
Can I raise a tangential point? They'll be very quick. Sorinola, it seems like a fullback to me rather than a wingback. When he's attacking, he's actually quite good, but he's always out of position for defence. When he's defending, he's really good defensively, but isn't like sort of up there. And when he's caught between the two, he's awful, like against West Brom. He doesn't seem to have that up and down that you really want out of a wing back. Now, like Miller is a good example. He's pretty good at going up and down as a forward. Whether his defence is up to it, that's another matter. But I don't blame him for that, because that's not his wheelhouse. That's not where he started off. He's been asked to sort of convert and does his best to that. But I find it weird with Sorinola that he seems more of a fullback than a wing back, because he was brought in specifically in the January window to play in this system. And that's does that baffle anyone else, that he seems more of a fullback than a wing, true wing back, and the playing wing back seems to shatter him after 60 minutes? Does that seem a bit odd to anyone else, given that he was brought in specifically to play as a wing back?
The differences between a fullback and a wing back are quite blurred in the age of, very attacking wing backs, and maybe talking about inverted fullbacks as is sort of played maybe at the top level. Maybe there are some distinctions starting to emerge again, but I think at this level, teams tend to play with overlapping attacking fullbacks who get up and down the pitch a lot, whether they're in a back four or a back five.
To be fair, Norwich's fullbacks yesterday were from the furthest forward players, weren't they? So, and they were technically fullbacks. So.
I think it's more to do with a lack of fitness, because he's played very little football. And I think I sort of agree with, what Joe was saying earlier, that hopefully I'm not a horse racing fan, but a summer on the grass or whatever it was that you said, he'll have the fitness to be able to play more 90 minutes.
That's the end of another episode of Green and White, brought to you by Argyle Life. Before you go, please make sure you drop us a review on whichever podcast platform you are using, and make sure you follow us on Twitter at ArgoLife1886. Cheers.
Away days are great, but there's nothing quite like playing at home. The same goes for McDonald's. Maximize your home ground advantage with McDelivery. Order now on the McDonald's app. At participating restaurants, 18 plus, serving times, delivery fee and terms apply. See mcdonalds.com.
This podcast is proud to be part of the TalkSport Fan Network.
TalkSport. Powered by fans.